the intervaling in nature is always that the rest, the pause, is an openness. In consciousness, the openness is not punctuated by anything phenomenal. And so it is not designatable as a space. If one were to talk about it, it would be, in fact, a superspace that would have mathematical qualities of supersymmetry. And if that were paired with phenomenal, natural space, that complementarity together would make it possible for there to be a hyperspace. And the hyperspace, mathematically, has 10 dimensions. The 4 dimensions of the natural cycle, time and the 3 space dimensions, have a complementarity of 4 dimensions in the ecology of consciousness. And those 8 are able to be woven together. And when they're woven together, the fabric that is woven of them as a complex whole, which not only has completeness, but now has perfection, perfectly complete, constitutes a 9-dimensional dynamic, which engenders a 10-dimensional hyperspace. We have talked about string theory and its refinement with M theory and many other refinements since then. And next week we'll return to Michio Kaku's interesting book on hyperspace, the 10-dimensional hyper, not phenomenal, not even super phenomenal, but hyper hyperspace. Architecturally, to express this in a symbol, one of the great triumphs of architectural expression was the building of Chartres Cathedral in France. And Chartres is even today a little village out in the fields. But to hold together the architectural resonances and particular harmonic of Chartres, very, very complex, where the transept and the nave come together, where there would be an altar, generally, at the navel of the cathedral. Instead, exactly at that place in the floor is a labyrinth, a maze, a very special maze. And in order to get to the center of that maze from the entry, you literally have to walk every square foot of the labyrinth in order to get to the center. So by the time you get to the perfect center, you will have completed the entirety of the outline and the substance of the form itself. It's a simple way of showing that completeness and perfection, when they are woven together, they now meaningfully indicate to you, not only visually, as in perception, or mentally as in conception, but the very kinesthetic activity of doing the labyrinth, of arriving at the center, and that one now has the flash of consciousness that the entire building is this kind of a labyrinth, and that you, at this pivot, are at the pivot of the entirety of the cathedral, no matter how complex and huge it is. And just a footnote, when Chartres was first finished after generations working on it, it had an enormous fire and burnt and had to be rebuilt again. So the Chartres that you see now is the rebuilding of it and the fierce dedication of all the farm people and the architects and the stone workers and everybody understanding, we're going to do this, we're going to make this again, and we're going to make it, and it'll be there, and it has been there for almost 1,000 years. In India, the building that occupies the pivot center of India is called Sanchi, S-A-N-C-H-I. This is one of four gates. Sanchi has four gates in the four directions. And at the center of the four gates is a domed structure, a stupa. And at the very top of the stupa is a series of circles arranged in such a way that one can understand many different kinds of symbolism, but what happens in the accrual of energy is that this is a condenser. It condenses the ambient energy into the building to vivify the structure so that it now is literally not only electrified, but super electrified. Not only electrified, but and super electrified, but magnetized and super magnetized. And if there is a conscious prismatic person in Sanchi, now there is a hyper electrification and a hyper magnetization. He who can selflessly occupy their presence at Sanchi will have the effect of being able, literally, to resonate with the entirety of India. The great volume on Indian architecture, Sir Percy Brown, in two volumes, this is the Buddhist, the other volume is the Hindu architecture, has a beautiful schematic here of Sanchi. But on the cover is a building that was a refined Sanchi. This particular stupa was called Amaravati, which is on the Krishna River, which is on the near the site where the Krishna River eventually some dozen miles down empties into the Bay of Bengal. The architect of Amaravati was Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna was one of the world's great philosophers, as well as being a masterful architect. He also designed the completion and perfection about 200 AD of what we know now as the Mahayana, Mahayana Buddhism. The origin of Mahayana Buddhism was a special figure named Ashvaghosha. In Sanskrit, Ashva comes from Asvan, it means horse. Gosha is the sound of the horse. When a horse is whinnying, that's Ashva Gosha. Not just a horse, but the royal mount, the steed of the true king. The interesting thing about Ashva Gosha, his first book on the Mahayana, which was refined eventually by Nagarjuna, his book in translation is called The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. The Awakening of Faith, and if you know anything about classical Buddhism, it's not about faith at all. The Theravada, the way of the elders, is to take apart whatever can be taken apart to reveal what occurs when everything that is compound is distributed into its dispersal parts, what occurs then? What is left? And the classical Buddha said, what you will discover that nothing is left. It will vanish. All phenomenal forms are composite. And if you are able in your method, in your analytic, in your practice, to be able to refine taking apart whatever can be taken apart, you will come to realize there is no self. That self is like a phantasmal projection. And where it records on an assumed background to the mind, to the symbolic structure of the mind. And because it's an assumed background, it then makes the mind function as if it were a mirror. As if it were glass backed with a silvery back, and now instead of being a glass to look through, it's a mirror that reflects. And one then even uses the term today in English, I'm going to reflect on something, I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think about it in terms of images. I'm going to think about it, reflect upon it in terms of its feelings, in terms of language, in terms of ideation. And the reflective mind then works in the phenomenal world because it has a referential correlation to existential things. And because that correlation is able to be honed, one can then have confidence in certainty in identification. Such is so. A is A. In the sequence, if A, then B. If B, then C. Thus, A, then C. But the cardinality of an order of identification carried over psychologically in reflection leaves the certainty that I am I. Whereas the Buddha's method was to dissolve that certainty and not make you frightened, but enlightened. However, with Ashva Gosha, now you have the awakening of faith. Not in the Theravada, not in the old way of the elders, but in the new great way. The teacher of Ashva Gosha, who brought him into connection with faith being like a premonition that there was a wider, there was a great way of perfection. His name was Parshva. Parshva came from the north part of ancient India, which is today in Pakistan, came from, and in Ashvaghosha's day, it was called Gandhara. And that section of northern India was a section that was developed by Greek kings following in the trail of Alexander the Great. But before there was an Alexander the Great and Greek kings in northern India, in the kingdom of Gandhara, there were several hundred years where the Persian Empire of Cyrus the Great extended that far, and there were Persian kings in northern India by about 540 BC. And just as the Greek kings connected India with the Mediterranean, the Persian kings connected India with the Mediterranean before them. And this was interesting because the religion of the Cyrus the Great Persian Empire was a Renaissance revival of the ancient religion of Zarathustra. But this time, at that time, they called him not Zarathustra, but Zoroaster. Zarathustra in the ancient Avesta language means he who is good with camels. Zarathustra's family name was Spitama. And his name literally meant that his family were really wealthy because they ran huge caravan routes. Camels. Not a camel driver like some kind of a peon, but they owned huge caravan routes. And where did those caravan routes go? They went in Central Asia along great river systems, the Amu Darya to the Hindu Kush, over a couple of passes, dropping down into the vast Gobi Desert and going all the way either north along what became the Silk Road or south along another road that I, a long time ago, named the Jade Road, because jade was discovered two tributaries near that, the town is what anciently was called Khotan, and today is Khotan. But the early Central Asian caravan routes were thousands of miles long, more than 4,000 years ago. But there was competition because the southern large trade routes that ran to India through Persia to the Mediterranean and later were the Greeks through Hellenistic kingdoms to the Mediterranean. The original Mediterranean to India trade routes was a civilization about 2350 BC, and the great master of designing that and achieving that was Sargon the Great, Sargon of Akkad. He took the matrix of Sumerian city-state league that had developed a tremendous way of unifying 42 different little city kingdoms into a tapestry of a single kingdom. And just at that time, Sargon was the one who took over the entire tapestry of the Sumerian city-states into a new kind of an empire whose religion was woven together by Sargon of Akkad's daughter named Enheduanna. And you can look her up on the net. There are many websites on Enheduanna, En in ancient Sumerian and then in Akkadian means holy. Enheduanna was the high priestess who did a spiritual hymn for each of the 42 temples at the center of the 42 city-states. and wove them together, so that her collection of temple hymns was a way of making a new kind of a conscious and phenomenal four-dimension time-space knit together in something new, a new form that had never been seen before. And it was the kingdom of kingdoms. And so Sargon was the first king of kings in the world. But he was Semitic, whereas the Central Asians were Aryans. So that you had an interesting kind of a bind, a parallel, that the first great international, inter-kingdom kingdom of kingdoms, one of those helixes was Aryan, the other was Semitic, and that they formed a tremendous complementarity. And the complementarity became apparent about 2000 BC. But its apparentness was so limited because there were very few exchanges between the two great swaths of caravan civilizations. The figure in the Central Asian heritage was Zarathustra, the original one, and the figure who was a contemporary of his in the Semitic southern one was Abraham. They both were born about 2000 BC. They were both capable of a kind of a differential time form expansion. And each one of them had a precursor about 350 years before. The precursor to Abraham was Sargon of Akkad. And his daughter Enheduanna was the high priestess in Ur. That's where the Temple of Temples was. And that's where Abraham was born. Ur of the Chaldees. His father's name was Terah. And if you went back from Abraham in 2000 BC, a double millennium, one went back to 4000 BC, and that was the time of Adam and Eve. And if you went 2000 years forward from Abraham, you came to the time of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. So Abraham becomes a pivotal figure in civilization because he is the pivot, the central figure in 4,000 years of history that are symmetrical together. And that people in Jesus' time, finally, after they got used to the fact that the appearance of these kinds of figures on this scale starts a new time form. And it's not just one time form, but all of the compartments of that time form that are time forms. The 2,000-year period at that time in Greek was called an aeon. And the two halves of an aeon were called millenniums. And the two halves of millenniums were called cycles of the phoenix, 500 years, and so on and so forth. So that every 2,000 years, one can see that there is a kind of a differential prismatic conscious originating of a whole new set of time forms, which means that the previous set of time forms all came to an end, all came to a close. And they came to a close in a very special way, that if someone were focusing on phenomenality, on existentiality, you would think time is coming to an end. That after such and such a date, there would be no more time. I think a movie is out now, 2012, the Mayan calendar. By the way, the Mayan calendar has a Chinese origin. there were huge Chinese fleets in the 400s AD that went not only across the Pacific Ocean, down the California coast, down the Mexican coast. I'll bring a volume next week, an esoteric volume from the 19th century, and there's a photograph of a Chinese ship anchor that was found in San Diego Bay, big round stone anchor, because they use that as a shifting point for them. If you look at the Mayan Indians, especially the highland Mayans, you can see the Chinese features. I had a friend from Santiago, Chile, who was a filmmaker, Rolando Klein, and he made a beautiful movie called Chak. This was in the 70s. Chak is C-H-A-C, as in the Mayan Chakmul, the rain god. And he used just villagers, no actors and actresses, in making Chak. And when I showed it here in Los Angeles, I premiered it here at the Philosophic Research Society, and Rolando was there, and he brought one of the villagers who was in the film. And when he sat in a chair on the stage in front of about 300 people, everyone was shocked that he looked Chinese Indian, the features and everything. And when you look at the outlines of the highland Mayans, the Lacandon Mayans, you see something which is indelible. And there was a volume done about 50 years ago now on psychoanalyzing the dreams of highland Mayan Indians, and their dreams are ancient wisdom. Even though one sees that they're just villagers, their psyche is enormously refined. They still have the layered accrual of high civilization that's still there in their dreaming, and occasionally in their visioning. But to transport vision into history takes a prismatic, jeweled person to be able to do this. Whereas the in-between of the natural cycle is just being able to experience, makes the phenomenal base of things and actions relatable to symbolic structures of understanding and integrating. And one just, to keep the experience enriched, fuels that, whereas the prismatic person must be composed artfully. Spirit persons are art forms. And to be able to mature a spirit person is a very high art. In the Mahayana, the document that classically, in the most pristine, simple way that expresses this, is the Vajracchedika, means the Diamond Cutter Sutra, the Diamond Sutra. And in the Diamond Sutra, there is a complete parallel of the words, the images, and their evocative tones to the central pivot of the sutra. And after that, there is a parallel of coming back down from it, so that the beginning and the end of the Diamond Sutra are tuned pair. And as one moves into the sutra or back from the end, the tuning forks come together at a single pivot. And what is at that pivot is the, in translation in English, the phrase, awaken the mind by not letting it rest anywhere. So that what occurs is the simple, pure continuity of eternity. The space of what is there when you take the back of the reflective mind and clean it, or purify it, or vanish its backing, now instead of a mirror, it's being able to look through. And when one looks through, one realizes there wasn't a glass there either in the first place. Just a pure openness. That pure openness, when it is recoverable out of one's life, is called an epiphany in Greek. And when you get used to an epiphany not being a moment in time, but rather being momentless in eternity, the epiphany turns out then in its infinite resonance to be a theophany. The earliest presentation of a theophany is in standing figures from ancient Sumer, and the figures all have enormous eyes. I'll bring illustrations of that next week. Their gowns have floral, geometric floral designs on them that look like four-leaf clovers. And they are all standing, and they have the eyes that are able to see through, so that the world has become transparent to them in terms of a theophantic amplitude. The way in which 500 BC this was expressed powerfully was in the Greek art form called the Choreia, C-H-O-R-E-I-A. And the Choreia had a couple of forms. One of them was a dance movement where you would move in a clockwise motion, and just as you were going to complete the circularity of that motion, you would pivot and go back the other way. And so that first movement in literary form was called a strophe, and the pivot was called a stand, and then the counter strophe. And this became the form of a very high poetic art, Greek lyric poetry, and the first really great Greek poets who used this. The female was Sappho, and the male was Pindar. And Pindar's very close best friend, Aeschylus, made this Choreia form the structure. When repeated four or five different waves of it, it became Greek tragedy. So lyric poetry, Greek tragedy, and very soon after that, Greek comedy, the Greek dance movements, all of this, because it had a Pythagorean base to it, that's very similar to the historical Buddha's base, because when Pythagoras studied in Egypt for 22 years, Egypt was a part of the Persian Empire. And then Pythagoras went to study Zoroastrianism for 11 years and wanted to go all the way to India because it was a part of the Persian Empire, but instead, he got to be in his 50s, and he realized that he was able to found his own school, in which he did, in the Aegean, in the Greek island of Samos. At this time, you find 500 years later, the time of the change when Jesus was alive and in the world, and the Pistis Sophia, the Faith Wisdom book, has a number of chapters. This is a little excerpt from chapter 84. They're very short chapters. And as a result of their exceeding great glory, you will reckon this world before you as darkness of darknesses, because it's opaqued by symbolic structures that only reflect phenomenality. You can't look through them. That's the darkness, the darkness of darknesses. And you will look forth upon the whole world of mankind, and it will become the size of a speck of dust before you as a result of the great distance. So the entirety of the world will become but a speck of dust that was there on that mirror. And then he goes on in this way, in this magnificent helical thing, and six times Jesus says, now the world that occurs to you, wherein this world is just a speck of dust, that will become a speck of dust. And by the sixth time, you realize that you have gone the distance of visual resolution such that it takes you back to the beginning of time. It takes you back before there was a time to blossom space to host phenomenality. So that what occurs there is eternity perfected, unsullied by any kind of emergence, other than the purity of what it is. The awakening of faith in the Mahayana has this kind of writing. The soul, as birth and death, that's samsara, comes forth as the law of causation, but the immortal suchness and the mortal birth and death coincide with each other, though they are not identical, they are not a duality. The same mind has a twofold significance as the organizer and producer of all things. It is the accumulation of this conserving mind, the Sanskrit is alaya vijnana, that gives the sense that what has happened has never not happened. And then he says, enlightenment is the highest quality of the mind. It is free from all limiting attributes of subjectivity. It is free from all limiting attributes of subjectivity. It is like unto space, penetrating everywhere as the unity of all. That is to say, the universal Dharmakaya of, and then he calls not the Buddha, but he calls him a Tathagata. Tathagata in Sanskrit means the Tathata, the suchness, is gata, gone. And what is always paired with the Diamond Sutra is the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra becomes, in the High Mahayana, the pivot of the Diamond Sutra, of the jeweled prismatic spirit person, whose heart then is the Heart Sutra, and the Heart Sutra is recited every morning by anyone practicing the Mahayana. And the center of the Heart Sutra is a talisman, and sometimes it's, it's shown as a flower, and looks for all the world, very similar to the flowers on the all-seeing eyes of the ancient Sumerian sages 5,000 years ago. Looks like the flower at the in the floor of Chartres Cathedral. It is the rosette, and in Sanskrit it reads, Gati Gati Para Gati Bodhisvaha. And it means gone, gone, perfectly gone. Hail enlightenment. More next week.